Well, welcome back, everyone.
Hi.
Katie's been off getting married. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So many lovely photos.
Yeah, there's more to come. You're going to be so sick of them by the time this is all over.
So what movie wedding was your wedding most like?
Oh, my God. I mean, people literally started reciting Steel Magnolias over and over again.
Oh, perfect.
I don't think it's because...
Always blush and bashful?
I wish, and I wish there had been an armadillo cake.
I was going to say.
But it was a lot of my mom's southern friends like showing up to just make everything happen and like wrap all the silverware and like rearrange all the tables. So that part of the stereotype is very true. Southern maids get anything done. I recommend them highly to help you at any event.
Oh, can they be rented out?
Maybe. I think my mom's friends have a new side business.
Perfect.
I can't speak for anyone else, but my life was not as exciting as Katie's recently. I've just been doing my thing. How about you guys? Anything?
Yeah, I can't compete with any of that. I made an armadillo cake for myself, but that
was
for like a Saturday afternoon.
That's an excellent idea, though.
I can compete with doing my thing. I've been doing my thing also. So
yeah.
I feel like I'm tied with Nathaniel. I'm
not sure. A three-way tie for second place.
Stop contest, you guys.
Did you all spend time with your mothers over Mother's Day? I missed you all on the podcast.
Yeah.
I was actually back in Buffalo for like a brief, like half a second. So I did actually sort of on my way back to New York get to see my mom on Mother's Day. So that was nice.
Mother's Day was also my grandfather's 90th birthday, so I was with him and my 87-year-old grandmother and my mother in Nashville.
Wow!
Yeah!
Points for endurance.
Yeah,
pretty
seriously.
Totally awesome. Yeah, the Keeling family genes. Way to go, huh?
Yeah, seriously.
That's like extra bonus point Mother's Day with all the grandparents, and yeah, you get major credit.
Totally, totally great. And my grandfather is now reading Mark Harris's book, which is awesome.
Your impact.
Yeah.
I guess I should say I was also in sort of a little bit of a fight with my brother-in-law at the Met Gala, but that really didn't come to much of anything.
And so. You really tried to keep that one under wraps. And then,
You know, family. I gotta, you know, nobody understands what we're going through.
You can throw a stiletto, though. I'm impressed.
Yeah.
All the way up there.
Okay, so now I guess we're tied for third place, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
We have two movies to discuss today, both big hits, so let's start with Neighbors.
Shall I moderate?
You shall, because you haven't seen that, right?
I have not.
Nick, before you moderate, I need you to give us your feelings about Zac Efron's abs. I think it's very relevant to how we will process the movie from here.
They're so gross. You know, I hate seeing them and wish that they would go away.
Yeah.
The
really
sheer...
just thought I'd learn how to keep a shirt on. No one wants
to. It's like, I don't know. If they were a movie, they'd be called, like, Vertical Limit or something.
Event Horizon.
See, you always win. Okay, so as somebody who's making up their minds to see Neighbors... what is the movie that if I like that movie, I will probably also like Neighbors?
Oh. I kind of feel like it's the 21 Jump Street of this year.
Whoa!
Oh!
Huge praise.
Which I know is high praise, and I liked 21 Jump Street better, but it still had that same feeling of like, this is succeeding in a genre I generally don't love, and exceeding expectations and being smarter about things than it even needs to be successful, and being more interested in more of the characters than a movie like this generally is.
Mm-hmm.
Overcoming my, let's say, predispositions against certain actors, like 21 Jump Street did with Jonah Hill,
this
kind of does with Seth Rogen, where they're not the best part of the movie, but they are in no way detracting from my enjoyment of the movie either.
And I think that's a lot because Seth Rogen, I mean, maybe probably more than Jonah Hill, knows how to get out of the way of the other actors and kind of is aware that there are other people doing good stuff and wants them to shine as well. It's very, I mean, it's overdoing it to say generous, but he does a really good job of not making it all about him.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Rose Byrne in Neighbors doesn't really even have an equivalent in 21 Jump Street, which makes it, on that level, a little bit even more enjoyable. I think I still like 21 Jump Street a lot better. But, like, I think I love the fact that coming out of that movie, so many of the critics that I follow on Twitter and listen to and read were talking about Rose Byrne in the movie above everything else, which I think is great, and which I think is probably appropriate, because that is a role in that kind of a movie that never seems to be interesting at all. And I think it's really kind of, it's, I mean, maybe damning with faint praise to say that, like, well, it's such a revolution because they are letting her be on par with everybody, with all the boy characters.
Mm-hmm.
But, like,
that's great, though.
We're starting from a deficit. So, like, that's good that we're there now.
Yeah, and that's a major flaw of 21 Jump Street, that you've got Brie Larson as this kind of cute character who doesn't do much more than be cute and, you know, have one good line or two. So that is a big step forward in that way.
Yeah, because, Nathaniel? Well, no, because Rose Byrne is very much a catalyst for a lot of the movie, actually.
She's a legitimate co-protagonist, which mm-hmm. hardly ever happens.
So, did you guys like it as much as the 21 Jump Street comparison? This is, like, the best answer I could have gotten, but does everybody like it the same amount?
I'd probably prefer 21 Jump Street a little bit. Although, 21 Jump Street, I think, once it becomes its big, like, sort of action comedy,
yeah,
toward the finale, loses me a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's much more fun as it goes along than in Resolution.
Yeah.
Whereas this one just sort of, like, steadily works, I think. So there's not as much highs and lows, I don't think. But as a whole, I probably prefer 21 Jump Street.
21 Jump Street.
But you were a fan of this.
Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't.
But you were a fan of this one.
Oh, yeah. It was really funny. And I wish it had more jokes. That's my only thing with it.
Yes.
Because it's... Maybe it's because we spent this spring sort of obsessing on Mean Girls. But so I'm comparing all these modern comedies to it just because I watched it like 3 times in that space to write all those, you know, things about it. And it's just really, it has so many jokes. And I find with modern comedies, it's really about, we have these actors who are really charismatic and funny, and we're just going to let them, here's a scenario and you just riff on it for a scene.
Yeah.
So there's like, even though there's really, really funny moments, there's not, the funny lines are few and far between, if that makes sense.
Yep.
And that's something that I think 21 Jump Street does differently. Like, the pace and the tone of the comedy in that movie is, it's really absurd. There's a lot of, like, weird flights into fantasy that Neighbors doesn't really do. The tone of Neighbors is much more similar to Forgetting Sarah Marshall or Get Up to the Greek, because, you know, it's the same guy directing these movies. But I think it's a better shape, like, it's more compact. I mean, the concept is so simple and straightforward, and it runs with that and kind of makes it interesting based on that one tiny premise, as opposed to, like, the 5-year engagement, which is so, like, meandering, which is where I think this really succeeded over the other movies that Nicholas Soler has made, that it really sticks to its premise, really digs into the characters it has in this one space and doesn't try to go bigger than that. I mean, it was an $18 million movie, which is still money, but pretty cheap by even comedy standards.
Yeah, geez.
Yeah. And it made like $50 million in its opening. It's this absurd success.
Well, and it's like short, which is like such a relief for a comedy.
Oh my God, such a relief.
And it's interesting that you lay out all of the Nicholas Stoller movies, because you don't really readily think of him in terms of, like, you know, consistent style. Right. But, like, he does make movies even if they are not the funniest things, and, like, 5-Year Engagement certainly had its problems, bloat being one of them. But he makes movies where there are a lot of characters who you're interested and like. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've only seen 5-Year Engagement, but...
Yeah, he doesn't make movies where you're just, like, you like one person and everybody else is kind of, like, an asshole orbiting that person.
Joe, this is not a podcast about Alexander Payne. You don't.
Let it go, Joe.
Nice job, Nick.
So
he's never far from our thoughts, apparently.
You guys have already raved about Rose Byrne, but it's basically a half and half between Rose Byrne is the best thing in the movie and Zac Efron is the best thing in the movie. And I think I might fall in the Efron camp. But I wondered if you guys were as enamored by him. I've always been a Zac Efron defender, so I was already in the tank.
I have to say that I'm not. I've always been agnostic about him and still am. And I don't even, this is jumping back to the abs discussion, I don't even really, like, in some ways it's a turnoff for me because it's so, like, yes, his body's beautiful, but it's almost like an exoskeleton. Because it's so severe, like, mm-hmm. you can see, like, every, like, muscles I don't even know the names of, you can see.
Body and, Worlds.
Huh?
Body Worlds. It's like that exhibit, that wax body. Right.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I don't know what it was, but it was especially the scene where they were doing a little barbecue on the front lawn, and he's shirtless, of course.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I was just alarmed for a moment. I was like, that's way too much anatomy on the screen for me. Like, I don't know what it was. I just don't. And I also.
He does give the sense of being more naked than he is because of the way that his body looks.
Yeah.
Because you're just like, you just feel like you're seeing so much of him. I don't know. It's like a surface area thing or something. I don't know. Like, it's science.
This could all go on the poster and it would make $200 million more dollars. Like, too much anatomy. It feels like you're seeing so much of him.
Yeah. Surface area.
Surface
area. Yeah.
And I feel like I think he's a good actor. I just don't think he's in any way better than good. And so, like, he has these scenes with people, and I'm always, even though he's very, very pretty, I'm always, like, way more interested in what the other actor is doing in the scene.
Dave Franco, because Dave Franco is like a placeholder.
Well, see, I would agree with that in most scenarios, but like, let's take the fact that we're dealing with comedy riffing rather than comedy
mm-hmm.
for a lot of this, like that scene where they do the bros before hoes like poem type of thing.
Yeah.
To me, that scene was kind of weak because it just went on and on, and I don't think Efron's super funny.
Yeah,
whereas Dave Franco is funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually really like Dave Franco in this. The Zac Efron thing, I'm kind of right on the fence between thinking he's an actually, like, undervalued actor and feeling like certain directors really know what to do with him and he's malleable in a way that's very valuable. But I think there's something about him in this particular movie. I think, Katie, on your site, Richard Lawson, who is a friend of mine, wrote something really, really smart about the way this movie sort of uses this kind of on the edge of, I can't remember exactly what the words, but almost on the edge of, like, scandal-ness to Zac Efron, that his good looks come with this sort of sense of
danger,
or sort of just like, or that he's on the edge of some sort of, like, breakdown. And I feel like it really contributes to his character in this. And I think there is a good bit of intent there, even if it's either him or the director or what. But I think whoever's making the decisions there, it comes across fairly effectively.
I'm a little lost. Are you guys talking about that he knows that he's riding on his looks? I'm not sure I follow what you're saying.
Not necessarily just that he's riding on his looks, but that there's, like, I don't know, that there's some damage to him, that there is.
Or, like, sociopathy almost. Like, that he's, like, kind of pretending to be, like, this clean-cut kid,
right,
as opposed to.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know, like, being someone who's, like, wrapped up in something bigger than him, like Seth Rogen is. Like, it's kind of, he doesn't care about it anymore. And I think there's something interesting in the way the movie moves on to kind of, it kind of talks briefly about, like, his future versus Dave Franco's future and how he just, like, he's not smart and he doesn't give a shit and, like, doesn't really have potential to go anywhere.
And then he ends up as a Abercrombie front store model.
I mean, it's
spoiler
kind of,
alert.
Yeah. It's kind Again, of surprisingly, disgusting. It's kind of surprisingly bleak about, like, you know, what some of these people do after college. And I think that combined with this element of Efron that's kind of very practiced, like, you kind of get that sense that he's, like, been performing for a long time, that, you know, he gives these speeches to, like, rally the troops in the frat, and he says how there's almost nothing to it. Like, he says the words, but he doesn't know what they mean. I don't know. Like, it's kind of hard to know how much of that is reading into it. I was reading when Richard wrote that, I hadn't seen the movie yet, and I kind of also struggled to understand what he meant, but I definitely see it. And I think that's something Efron is bringing to it that's different from just, like, I'm going to be funny.
Well, and I think exoskeleton actually is kind of the right word. And I think there's a little bit of intention to that, where he's like, this external facade of, like, perfection, of, like, physical perfection, and sort of very clearly, I think, masking something. And
well, there's also real-life drug problems.
Well, this is what I mean. It all sort of, like, ties into this image that makes a lot of sense both on-screen and off-screen.
So, existentialism via Neighbors. This
is saying, like, this gives you a little bit to think about.
So what I'm getting so far is that we're going to get Rose Byrne out of this, Zac Efron's surface area, Zac Efron as an existential quandary, and Seth Rogen generously stepping aside. So I have two more questions. One is, how much time do we spend with the character called Ass Juice?
It's isn't that the kid from Submarine?
It is, yeah. He's really good in this.
He is
a brief but pivotal interlude, I would say, is the Ass Juice content.
Question 1A is, how often do they call him Ass Juice?
Pretty often.
At IMDb.
Every time you see him.
All right.
And the way Rose Byrne says it in her native Aussie accent, which I'm so glad they let her keep, is the funniest thing about any of the Ass Juice scenes.
Rose Byrne in this movie makes me wonder why anyone ever has to do a fake accent for anything. Like, please just let everyone speak in their natural accents.
Oh, I have to say that about Happy Christmas, too, but that Melanie Lynskey gets to be from New Zealand, and I loved it.
Nice.
So it's like, I agree with that. I think more, if it's not crucial to the character in any way, why not let them use their own voice?
Stoller did that for Emily Blunt.
For Emily Blunt, yeah.
We're almost reaching an enlightenment of sorts with this. Because Toni Collette got to be her.
Oh, yeah. In
said.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we're on the precipice of everybody sort of figuring out that there is no benefit to sacrificing, you know, the natural talents of these actors just to make it make a little bit more, like, you know, technical, nitpicky sense.
Oh, Daniel Radcliffe in What If? That is coming out later this summer. He has his English accent.
Maybe someone will find out that Uma Thurman be from Europia. So my other question is, why are you all such jerks and none of you told me this was a Lisa Kudrow movie? In which case, I would have gone to see it on Thursday.
I think if you go to see this as a Lisa Kudrow movie, you will be disappointed.
Yes.
Mm. Oh, that's fucking bleak.
She's in about as much of it as she has in Easy A, maybe less.
And in kind of an Easy A? Oh, she was principal. Oh, right.
Yeah.
And it's the same role, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. With actually less going on.
All right.
I have a question for you guys, if it's okay.
God, you're ruining my life.
I know. did you guys read Peter Kinnock's thing on IndieWire about, like, talking about the gay, like, not even subtext. He was kind of, like, arguing for it as being text and, like, what the movie was about. And I was kind of confused by the argument. I didn't know if either of you had read it and bought it. Kind of taking off, like, Seth Rogen, he sees Zac Efron for the first time. He's like, that guy looks like he's made by a gay guy in a lab. And it's very kind of upfront about the idea of all these frat brothers, like, kind of loving each other in ways they don't totally, that's not as straight as they think it is.
I think it's a bit of a stretch.
I think it's a bit of a stretch, too, and I was curious if you'd found anything interesting in it. Although I do give it credit for, you know, being a movie about a bunch of dudes that has a serious lack of gay panic, which is something that still shows up so often in comedies like this, so credit.
Well, this is what, I feel like it's sort of the Rose Byrne thing. Like, I think it's great that we're giving a movie where Rose Byrne gets to play on the same playing field as the boys. I'm not sure how much feminist cred I want to give it for just being what it should be. And I feel like giving a movie credit for not having gay panic seems like, I don't know. I don't want to do that.
It's like, thank you for clearing that low bar.
A little bit better. You have to be a little bit more proactively good for me to give you, like, whatever, the Gay Medal of Freedom.
Which you are the only person in charge of giving out.
Yes. Well, I'm, you know, it's my award.
You take your job very seriously.
I don't know. I think I completely agree with what you're saying, Joe. But I do have to admit that the lack of gay panic, particularly in, spoiler alert, the dildo fight scene,
mm-hmm.
was...
Nick, write that down.
That's not a spoiler. Every movie has a dildo fight scene.
Was actually shocking to me. Because, like, the punchline where the gay panic punchline would go is really funny, but it has nothing to do with gay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, that's not just, writers not being lazy. It's them not having any gay panic at all. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, they like there's no intention of ever going there, even though it seems like the scene where you would most definitely go there.
I totally get that. But I don't know. Something in the back of my head is just being like, well, congratulations for not saying anything racist in your movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like that line in The Loop where he's like gets credit for, like, he's really late to the meeting. And it's like, well, you didn't shit yourself either. You want credit?
Well, some movies, that's the best they can say for themselves. Revolutionary Road, no racism.
It reminds me of, like, a big drama on Mad Men whenever Peggy wants, you know, praise or whatever, and Don would be like, that's what the paycheck's for.
Yeah.
Very famous Mad Men moment.
That the financial success of Neighbors will, you know, maybe then this is just a template that comedies will go with, and that's a really good thing. Like, in the way that
you mean template, like naked Zac Efron template.
Well, yeah.
No, he means dildo fight scene. Like, I've only ever seen that in Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. Now I can finally take off as a thing.
I think the Paperboy re-release is now going to make so much money. This naked Zac Efron thing. Is
like, yeah. Well, and I mean, even, you know, you can sort of even draw the line from, like, remember after, like, 30-year-old Virgin, you know, the 30-year-old Virgin, that very famous movie. after 40-year-old Virgin and that sort of, that I know how I know you're gay scene,
mm-hmm.
got copied, like, 40 different times in subsequent movies. And the descendant of that scene in this movie is that Bros Before Hoes scene, and that, mm-hmm. like, aesthetically it's the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, progress, that, you know, movies don't feel like they need to have this, you know, homophobic runner in their movie. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think if there's the takeaway from why it was such a big hit, it's because there was so much to appeal to so many different people, including having Rose Byrne and including shirtless Zac Efron, like, because women made up a surprisingly large amount of the audience, and that is, I don't know, that's got to make them at least more interesting, if not better, like, having more of these movies that are starring dudes but able to appeal to women. Like, that's a step.
Well, and also you can bring your own gay panic if you need that.
Yeah, just like some people sneak Cokes in their purse.
You can buy an extra ticket for it, but it'll be there.
You'll be fine. Well, thanks for coming to my show. We've hit 30 minutes. You get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car.
So should we move on to Godzilla?
I was going to say, speaking of cars, how many of them get crushed in Godzilla?
So many.
Lots and lots.
Less than I was expecting, actually.
Yeah?
Well, there are probably a lot of off-screen crushed cars.
Yeah. Actually,
I feel like the number of, like, off-screen deaths that happen just as the camera makes it past is a lot in Godzilla.
There's
hundreds of millions.
Well,
that's actually what I like about it, though. It wasn't fetishizing, like, I don't know. Like, I know this is a bad example because everybody hates this movie, but, like, Transformers. It seems like any movie where entire cities are destroyed.
Yeah.
It's like the destruction is like the sort of blowing your wad thing. Whereas in this movie, it seems like the destruction is always just before the camera shows it.
Yes, but here's the thing that I thought of when it comes to, because you do see that a lot in Godzilla, is you'll spend about, like, maybe 20 seconds with a character. It's not like a character. It's an extra, but it's an extra that you sort of linger on a little bit, so you have enough time to register them as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie will sort of, like, move on. And you're left to sort of assume, like, you have to make that leap in your mind to just be like, oh, so, like, in about 30 more seconds, that person probably got crushed by something. Whereas I feel like in a movie like Independence Day, do you remember the part in Independence Day in that first big attack where, like, there's that guy in the cab, or, like, Harvey Fierstein even, where, like, you see them and then the fireball comes right for them and you don't necessarily maybe see them get, like, engulfed in flames on camera, but the movie, like, turns away soon enough that you're just like, oh, and then they die. Like, it allows you to meet characters, feel for them as people, and then know actively, and then they died. And I feel like these sort of monster disaster movies these days maybe want you to forget about that person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I consider,
necessarily think, like, oh, mm-hmm. that person died. They want you to think everything died.
Like Man of Steel being
I was just
going to
say that.
Yeah,
and Godzilla and Godzilla goes out of its way to show people being evacuated and to kind of, you know, if Elizabeth Olsen has any purpose in this movie, and it's debatable that she does, it's that she gives it the perspective of that person kind of hanging on for dear life in the middle of this chaos in, like, the BART station shelter.
Yeah.
I mean, his best idea is to put her kid on a bus to nowhere. Hold on. Before I tend to people, I just need to make sure I'm not with my kid during all of this. Wow. Okay.
I think it's a leap to say that any human character matters in this movie, except for maybe Bryan Cranston and maybe Ken Watanabe.
Yeah.
It's like a movie that you're watching make up its mind about whether it wants to be character driven or not. Like, because it felt to me like, I don't know if it did to you guys, like the first 20 or 30 minutes weren't only the kind of perfunctory like setting of the scene so that soon we can get a monster. Like, it actually felt like we might really be kind of deep impacting through these characters when the movie gets going. And then at a certain point, it just like for sure was not that. And then there are people like Sally Hawkins who it's like, oh, bleak. Like, let her do something. Like, she can't just stand behind Ken Watanabe going, what do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that she's, like, one of the main scientists, but, like, all... And Ken Watanabe, too. Like, anything that's important is what Bryan Cranston knows.
Yeah.
Like, none of the other scientists, even though they have even more time... sort of show their worth. They think of nothing and they do nothing.
It's funny because I feel like this movie is probably more egregious with the thinly drawn human characters than any summer blockbuster probably in the last 5 years. And yet I'm so much more forgiving of it because I feel like the story at least comes to a point where that is sort of baked into the theme of the movie, which is that puny humans think that they, you know, matter, basically.
Yeah.
And there are giant elemental forces of nature that prove that they don't. And I think if you're going to give me a movie that makes sense on that thematic level, then I'll forgive and maybe even read intention into the fact that your human characters are laughably thin.
Yeah, because the human characters are laughably thin in the vast majority of circumstances where you're building up to this big crashing finale in the city. I mean, to bring up Transformers again, or even the Avengers, where it's not really the characters that you're following. It's kind of the fluidity of the action. So, and I'm like, I don't hate on Aaron Taylor Johnson as much as most people. I thought he was fine.
He's so handsome.
He's really handsome, and he is fine as being like the boss, you know, the Hurt Locker sequel, basically, where he's kind of wandering into all of these circumstances. And then when it gets to, I mean, I think a lot of people want to talk about the ending because the ending is really remarkable and it's what kind of leaves you on a high note. But when you get to that big ending sequence and it basically goes silent, there's so little dialogue in the big final scene because it's really handing things over to the monsters. And Ken Watanabe says, let them fight. And then from that point on, the people don't matter. And the people who we are left with matter enough for it to be like, oh, I see what it's like to be cowering away from Godzilla because he's huge. Like, they're basically there as perspective. And that's about it. And it's fine.
Did you guys see this with audiences or at critic screenings?
I saw
it with audiences.
That behaved like an audience.
Yeah, I saw it with half audience, half critics.
I saw it with complete normal audience.
So, me too. So, did everybody else have the experience of the audience massively cheering for Godzilla?
Oh, yeah.
Like, isn't that kind of weird?
That's always been the case with Godzilla, though.
It's so weird.
Well, I mean, it's a
hero in this one.
Yeah, and it's a sort of franchise of nostalgia.
But I almost felt like it was flipped. Like, the audience was definitely not cheering for Godzilla as a movie, and there were times where the theater was palpably trying to figure out whether they thought it was good or not. But they were behind that fucking lizard.
Oh, yeah.
And so they really, like, cemented themselves to the movie once he was like, I don't know, Godzilla as a figure of moral sense seemed kind of surprising to me. I see what's going on up there. Better go help him out. And then not spoilers, whatever, but, like, in the last, like, 30 seconds as he sort of rejoins his natural environment, it was like, let me just... Oops, carefully step around. I don't want to knock anything else over. You guys
that
have just
really
been through
funny.
Enough. So he kind of, like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, he was like that with the bridge, though, earlier in the movie.
Yeah.
So you do get the sense that he is the protagonist that you don't spend any time with until the end of the movie. But I think the disconnect people are having with it in terms of, like, you know, what am I supposed to, you know, focus on because of the thinness of the human characters? I think that's really exacerbated by Aaron Taylor Johnson, though. Like, I know, Katie, you're forgiving of him, but I don't, like, and I feel the exact way, same way Joe does about his beauty. I think he's so pretty, and for me, way prettier and more attractive than Zac Efron, for example.
Yeah.
But there's just no leading man charisma. Every time I've seen him, I'm bored. Even though he's pretty, like, and he keeps getting these big parts, and then I don't feel anything about him.
I've heard strongly on this podcast that you hate handsome people, which is
an unacceptable bias.
Well, I just here's my thing with
they didn't ask to be born that way.
But here's my thing with that: there's the most actors are attractive, so you give the parts to the people who also have charisma.
Because we're back to Math 101.
Because it's two different things.
I think, though, I'm trying to picture what this movie looks like with an actor who is sort of getting his charisma all over the camera. Like, and I just wonder if that gets in the way of what the movie is trying to do. And I'm not saying that you need to have an actor as sort of awkward as Aaron Taylor Johnson is in this movie, because he is. Like, there's another actor where just, like, just let him have an accent. Like, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
This weird sort of, like, proto old-timey Brooklyn somewhat thing is weird on him. But, like, someone else on the internet, and I can't remember who it was like, but think about, like, Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man, and, like, good God, would I have been so annoyed by an actor.
Yeah.
Like, throwing his, like, charmingness or whatever in front of the camera as much as somebody like Robert Downey Jr. does. And I know that that's, like, an extreme example. But, I feel like any kind of active charisma gets in the way of what the movie's trying to do.
I don't really agree, just because the other actors with the thinness of their roles still read as, like, people you'd want to know more about. Which I think is good, because the movie does clearly, even if it has a problem with characterizations or maybe it's purposeful, it does still actually want you, I think, inarguably, to care that people die. So,
do you feel like Aaron Taylor Johnson keeps you from caring that people die?
No, but for example, Juliette Binoche, mm-hmm. and Bryan Cranston, they have these short amount of times to make quick impressions, and they really are going for sort of intense feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And even Sally Hawkins, who has nothing to do, boy, is she intense about worrying about it. You know?
Yeah.
So, I don't necessarily need the active, like, look at me type of star charisma, but, like, Victor Razek, who I love, he shows up as a soldier. And I want to know way more about him. Like, flip the roles. Like, give me somebody who I like, feel invested in automatically.
See, I don't think he made an impression at all in any way.
Yeah, I have no idea who you're talking about.
Oh. He's the soldier that Aaron Taylor Johnson hooks a ride with.
Oh, okay.
I think the differential here is whether or not you're in the camp who spends the rest of our lives being like, if you were in Raising Victor Vargas, I'm with you. I will like you. I want to know what happens to you.
Probably, yeah.
I did not feel, not that this is the movie's biggest obligation. It's hilarious how we're not talking about, like, the monsters or the effects or how beautiful it was. But it did not strike me as a movie that cared if people died. And in fact, like, part of what freaked me out about the Godzilla as moral hero thing was just the very Man of Steel, like, sheer scale of watching, like, at least hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people die, you know, huge buildings being toppled over through all these fights. It cared if people that we had been introduced to died. Like, I agree with you about the emotional intensity of that stuff, but collateral damage just didn't seem like a problem. It even struck me as hilarious that each new city where the action moves, nobody acts like they've been watching this on TV, even though we have, like, 18 scenes of people seeing the news on TV, but Las Vegas is just partying. They're doing good. Hey, what's that, huh?
Yeah,
San Francisco, things are fine, and then all of a sudden they're, oh shit.
I thought that was funny about Vegas, though, because Vegas is so closed off from the world when you're there. like that whole ad campaign is brilliant, specifically because that's how Las Vegas feels. Like the fact that they shut you off from the world purposefully.
Fair enough. Yeah. That was like a funny joke, which there are some good ones in this movie, like prying open the windowless casino and being like, "Hello." But
that shot of the television on the bank of slot machines is actually the least realistic thing in the movie because they would never put a TV in there.
Yeah.
They don't want you to know what's going on.
We found the logical hole.
It's the only thing I don't believe in.
Well, we should probably talk about what is. I loved the movie, and it sounds like we didn't love the movie from this conversation, but I loved it.
I really liked it.
I thought
it was the most beautiful movie I've seen all year in any genre in terms of the photography. I thought...
Well, yeah, and the color palette and just everything. It was so gorgeously made.
Yeah.
So it's having fun with what it's doing with the color palette. Like, I feel like when we talk about that it's grim, or not grim, that it's serious and it's beautifully shot, that makes me think of like Batman or Man of Steel or something. But the way that it deals with the monsters itself and that it surprises you and that it sets up your expectations and then meets them, and that there's just so much play with geography and the way that these monsters work, that is such a relief because so many blockbusters don't do that. And I love how much, like, it gets to the point where if Godzilla uses his tail, you're like, yeah, he uses his tail. I'm like, 5 minutes earlier, I didn't know I cared if he would use his tail. Like, it just does that over and over again. It makes it so fun to watch.
There's nothing in any of those Dark Knight movies that I would ever want to have, like, framed on my wall the way I want that skydiver scene.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Screen captain framed. I think it's just, there are about three or four shots within that same sequence that, like, breathtaking, I think, is not overstating the case. I think it's really something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing that was shocking to me about that scene, which is my favorite in the movie, is that it has this weird friction between that it looks, like, enormously peaceful, yet it's in the middle of like, the most violent, intense part of the movie.
Yeah.
But there's something about it that, so it comes off as sort of like a dream sequence. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I think especially in a genre that sort of tries to convey awe a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I mean, the sheer number of Spielberg faces you see in this movie, like, is sort of part of this grand tradition of, like, because those show up in every movie. And this is the rare movie that actually at certain points earns that kind of awe. And I think in that scene specifically, maybe not in every scene, but in that one, like when they're just sort of gliding down past the monster and only seeing like little parts of it, but like taking that moment to just have to, like, you have to stare at it as you're going down because holy fuck.
Yeah. I'm also a big fan of the shot that's in the trailers, or at least in a clip online, where Godzilla's foot shows up at the Hawaiian airport, where you kind of watch a plane explode and then another plane explode and then like that footsteps. It's so, like, the scale of the monster, they have so much fun with in terms of, like, just putting it up against all of these different things that you understand. So you really get how big not only Godzilla is, but the other monsters, which I guess...
Well, that couple times when, like, they don't see the monster because they think it's a mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, and I love, like, that he, even after reveals, he still plays, like, I know people are... And not just me, I'm sure other people are comparing it to Jaws a little bit, in that it doesn't really focus on showing you the beast or whatever.
Yeah.
But then when it does, it somehow treats it every time like it's a big reveal, which I just loved.
Yeah.
Because it's not like, oh, now we've shown you, so here you go. You know? Because I love all the shots that are like silhouettes.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's, you know, obstructed views or, like, there's a great shot of Aaron Taylor Johnson where he just sees the shadow of the tail as he's making his way through the city. And it's, I just love that the editing and the cinematography sort of always is so often putting you a beat behind where you're expecting to be. Both with destruction and, like, just character stuff, you know?
So my question is, will any director ever catch up to Gareth Edwards when it comes to scenes of monsters having tender, emotional, pseudo-sexual moments on screen? Because he seems to really like that if we go by this movie and monsters.
Well, I have a question for everyone. Am I the only one who hasn't seen Monsters?
I haven't either.
I have.
Okay. So
Nick's going to get that joke. Excellent. Great.
Well, no, but like, it's relevant because I was really super curious about that movie after seeing this. So I'm I'm wondering how much, if you guys were thinking about that movie while you were watching it, or if you think, I hope it leads people back, like, how would you compare them?
I think this is a better movie than Monsters. I think Monsters is a movie that worked for me on about half the time. I think it has a lot of the same tendencies in that the scenes when you actually do see the creatures and that kind of palpable sense of awe and wonder at like how much bigger things can get in the universe.
Yeah.
Is good. I think it has a similar problem of human characters not being that great. I think in that movie it matters a lot more. I think you're really supposed to, I mean, so much of that movie is just the human character story, and that's not the strongest part for me. I think Monsters was a movie that showed promise, and I like that a lot of that promise is being paid off in Godzilla. I feel like his career arc is a really positive one at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Nick, did you feel similarly, differently?
I had the same reaction to Monsters and Godzilla, and it was just like the same stuff at bigger scale. Like,
yeah.
I forget who said it. It might have been you, Joe. But like beyond like not being maybe as adept with human characterization, I do get the feeling from both movies that he's maybe not that wild about the human race. Maybe you said this, Katie. I forget. But like that shot in Godzilla where, you know, the last thing you've heard is like, you know, please just stay off the roads. And then there's like the fucking idiots cut to like, you assholes. Like,
yeah. No.
And like there's a lot of that stuff enough in Godzilla that I think that the overwhelming sympathy with monsters as against people is manifest in both films. Like Scoot McNairy, who he kind of discovered in Monsters, who's the lead, is overtly antagonistic to audience sympathy, I would say, in Monsters.
Yeah.
And similarly, both movies have scenes that are so beautiful, and they always involve the monsters, that it can make even, in my experience, like 10 or 20 minutes of stuff that wasn't really working be like, I'm still totally happy that I'm here. But I do get the sense that he really wants to be like an abstract colorist or painter and make cool images about monsters. And like, if that means like having crazy red dye shooting out of paratroopers, like I'm gonna do it because it looks awesome.
Yeah.
And so I kind of wish he could, you know, that the world existed so that he could work in a form that he just got to do that the whole time. Because sometimes, like, the cinematography gets kind of aggressively ugly even when he's just bright lighting all the human characters in their conversations. And it looked a little like 50s pastiche homage, but sometimes it just looked like a yucky looking movie, like sometimes, until he got to do what he wanted, which is have it be nighttime and have the monsters come back out. And then it was gorgeous. So, I don't know.
I thought about Avatar a number of times during this movie. I think I'm the world's last Avatar defender, so maybe I think about it more than most people. But
Last Avatar defender is going to be the name of the sequel forever.
That's true.
It's better than being the last Airbender.
It will be made just for me, and I will pay to see it 10 times. But, you know, in terms of the human characters being not that dynamic, Sam Worthington being, you know, Aaron Taylor Johnson level, like, handsome but uninteresting. And I think it's the same thing that you were saying, Nick, where, like, Cameron never seems all that interested in people. And is really just kind of trying to get up to the point where he could do what he wants to do with this world that he's created. And I mean, I think if Gareth Edwards is going to be the next Cameron, that's fine. Like, cause he has the nailing of geography. He knows how to make these giant action sequences. And I think he pulls it off maybe even better than Cameron does in some movies where he's trying to pretend to care about people just and kind of really sets up the blocks to get to what he wants to get done. So that doesn't really bother me.
I feel like Avatar was a real anomaly for Cameron seeming as stiff with his people.
Cause usually
I feel he really manages to do all of it to like a remarkable degree.
Well, I think about Titanic, which is like, I mean, I love Titanic more than most people, but he kind of like has the people that he cares about, but then he's also, you know, content to let Billy Zane just kind of stand there and glower. Like he does, you can kind of sense him itching to get to what he's trying to get to, but maybe he's also just growing into caring about his people less since the days of, you know, the Abyss or something.
Since the days when he was actually a normal human being.
But he wasn't just like living in a submarine.
Right.
He just thinks these are a bunch of people who don't even know about digital photography. They could die. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm curious, just because so much of the audience response, at least with my audience, was about nostalgia. It wasn't just that Gareth Edwards is terrific at shooting these big scale monsters and action sequences, but that people already have genuine affection for those things. So they're bringing it with them because this is a franchise with a 60-year history, and like a lot of people, including myself, grew up as little kids watching those old movies on TV. But I don't know, like, younger people today, I don't know if they did that because there's so many channels that, you know, it probably wasn't like that. But when I was young, there was not that many channels, so some of them showed monster movies and you watched them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like, the entire generations grew up sort of loving these things, and I could feel that in the room, like, when the tail lit up, for example, when the scales lit up, people just went wild, you know?
Nathaniel, I really want to thank you right now because you are putting me in the same category as young people, which I rarely get to feel these days. I somehow missed Godzilla growing up almost entirely. I also never saw the 1998 movie.
I didn't either.
This is the first Godzilla movie I've ever seen. So there's so much about, like, Godzilla the creature, Godzilla the myth, that I had no idea. Like, my basic understanding of Godzilla was giant lizard attacks Japan, created by radioactivity. Like, that was basically my understanding. So I had no idea about the thing where he eats radioactivity.
Is that new? I felt like that was added in this, so he eats radioactivity.
I can't remember. the only thing I remember from childhood is the monsters fighting each other, because that was like the hook of every
movie.
That's
the thing you want to see, yeah.
Godzilla versus whatever, you know?
Yeah, I didn't know whether this other monster was Mothra or not, and I kind of, like, whatever. The thing where he barfs the blue laser into the other character, the other monster's mouth, mm-hmm. that got the biggest applause line. Any
God, they went nuts. Yeah.
Of the whole, my assumption is that that's like a super fan servicey thing and like awesome. I just had no idea that like these were the components of Godzilla, which was like made it really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, I was similarly behind. I did see the 98 Godzilla and remember virtually nothing about it. So that didn't say
much. Not Maria Patillo? Are you kidding?
Wait, for what?
Not Maria Patillo? Are you kidding?
Oh, yeah, all and Jean Reno. I just had such a Jean Reno crush from that. Yeah, so I also didn't know much about Godzilla. Although I did watch the original Godzilla for my other podcast recently, and it's a really interesting movie. From what I understand, none of the other ones are worth watching as an adult, but the first one's kind of interesting. So, if you want to watch some more monsters, Joe.
Yeah.
So, am I really the only one with a history with Godzilla, then?
I had never seen any of them.
Wow, okay. Now I feel super old. Oh, my God.
You set yourself up for that. I don't...
You're an iconoclast, though, now.
So. I'm trying to figure out how to get you out of it, but I can do nothing.
No, I mean, it's just interesting. I mean, I suspected it was one of those things. Like, there are other old franchises where people are where you can tell generational things are in the way, like another one is Tarzan. So basically anything that used to show when there were only three networks and that kids used to watch, it's like I don't know when the cutoff date for that is, but it was probably in,
I think, maybe the VHS era is what stopped us from doing that, because like
the middle of the 80s or something.
Yeah, because like we would have tapes of like Disney movies, which is what I ended up watching over and over again.
Yeah, so that is probably the cutoff. So anybody who didn't live through the 70s and early 80s type of thing,
same problem. Grace of Monaco is happening. If you weren't around in 2001, you're like, I don't give a fuck. It should go down. You know, you were here for Nicole Kidman, or you weren't. She's the Godzilla of that movie, is what I'm saying.
Is that your fake can review? You haven't seen Grace of Monaco, but that's your review of it.
I've seen it in my mind.
Haven't we all?
Yeah, Nathaniel, I look forward to our review of Grace of Monaco. See how this goes.
I don't know that we'll ever get to see it.
No, the Weinsteins picked it back up, didn't they?
Yeah, but they also, they've picked up so many things over the years. They're like, oh, that movie? Where they just sort of keep it in their vaults.
Are you saying it'll get a Best Foreign Language Film nomination in 2 years and then nothing else ever?
They'll redub it in French.
They'll add in a whole lot more action scenes with Jet Li and it will be a huge success.
Yeah, I'm not confident that we'll get to see it in any regular capacity.
So if Grace of Monaco and Diana will wind up so much more similar than you ever would have guessed.
I think it's going to get the WE Costume Design Awards mini release.
You think
in,
so?
Like, that one mall per city that's behind a parking garage, which is what happened to WE literally in Chicago. but, you know, they don't want to not get a nomination. Like, let's be clear.
It's still a movie with a princess in it.
So, yeah, right. Maybe she can sing Alone Yet Not Alone and finally get that nomination back, too.
Or Masterpiece. But sing
or
it
Masterpiece.
Or sing it before the end credits.
Any of those things. Yeah, retrofit it as a musical. They've got time.
Just, like, cut it up and put scenes of it in other Weinstein Company movies and pick them out.
They're having trouble with The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, so why not just give it?
Oh, doesn't that make you sad that they, like, I know this is going back into the podcast Katie and I were not on, but, like, that really bums me out that they fused that movie back together.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen any part of it? I've seen none of it.
Oh, no, not me.
I've seen both parts. So I'm actually excited since they're releasing it all three ways.
Are they?
Yeah.
That's what they say now, yeah.
That's what they say now, is that they're going to release the Fuse version in September. Supposedly 3 weeks later, they will release the original two-parter.
So it's Grindhouse. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Basically.
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing.
So at least I get this sense that people understand that anybody who likes it will want to see, like, the full thing. But I'm curious about it because I did really like it, but I did also, it is very sort of like raggedy.
Yeah.
Because he's just sort of clearly going with whatever interests him about, and so both movies become about this huge ensemble of characters when it's really at its core about a marriage.
I'm going to use you as my guinea pig there, where I'm going to have you see the fused version and then tell me in what order I should watch them.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm super curious because I think it might actually be better as a fused movie, but maybe that's just my aversion to long movies. I don't know.
Yeah. I like that we've wound up talking about these art house movies after talking about Godzilla.
Oh, Godzilla is an art house movie. It's just disguised. Well.
And Grace of Monaco is a monster movie, so hello.
Tim Roth plays the monster, right?
You're never going to get away with saying something.
No,
like
I think
Daniel say. I'm sorry.
I think France is the monster, not Nicole. Hello, Nicole Defender over here. France is the monster. It wants to eat Monaco. That's the plot, as far as I can tell from the reviews. And she's like, "You will not eat Monaco today."
And then does she like?
And then she barfs in France's
mouth. I was going to say, does she shoot lasers into France's mouth?
It says we will not pay our taxes.
That's right.
Oh my god.
You learn about everything on this podcast. You learn about
everything. I have to say.
You learn about like ancient politics between France and Monaco.
And abdominal muscles.
Ancient.
We are a full
ancient Monaco.
As ancient as I'm feeling when all of you admit that you'd never seen any Godzilla movies before.
Talmud's better than you, Nathaniel. We're reading books and playing outside.
I don't even. Wait, what?
Yeah, no.
I actually think more books than playing outside happened before there was
that's true.
A thousand channels.
No, I was just watching the same Disney movies on VHS all the time.
Yeah.
And I was watching Steel Magnolias so as to have a concept of Katie's wedding.
Exactly. I've been you were catching up way in advance.
Prepared for 25 years.
Okay.
Was that a 1989 movie? Is that going to be an anniversary coming up soon?
Yeah,
it is. It's 25th anniversary of this show.
Oh, God.
I did a run-through anniversaries recently, and that was definitely on the list.
Can we do a podcast where we just, like, do a read-through of that entire movie as a radio play?
Oh, my God.
You know it's Nathaniel's favorite.
We need more people, though. We need
Let's get recruiting, you guys. We can do, like...
Wait, but we're going to have such fights over who plays who.
That's true.
That.
Wait, who? All right, everybody at the same time, say the character you'd want to play. All right, ready? 1, 2, 3, Weezer.
Weezer.
Wait, Nick and Nathaniel, what did you say?
I didn't speak up.
Nick said Dolly Parton, which
I was trying to look down the cast list to see my choices.
Katie, I will graciously take Miss Clary, and you can.
Oh,
have
wow. Her.
Well, then I get a Nell.
Oh, that's the biggest admission of defeat I've ever heard in my life.
No, I love Anel.
Okay.
Joe, your goal is just to be in the locker room is what I'm hearing.
Basically, yes.
So then who do we force to be Shelby?
I'll do it.
We'll do a feeder contest. We'll do a contest on the blog.
Can we convince the boyfriend to be Malin?
Yes.
Can we
he knows every line already. So
is he finally ready for his close-up? I mean, he's devoted.
He is devoted.
I want to get Guy Lodge involved in this somehow, just to hear his accent saying, you know, maybe probably Truby's lines.
We also need one person to play all the male roles, to play like Drum and Jackson and like whoever else.
Katie, do you think Patches would do it?
Oh yeah, I guarantee he would.
This is going to be a huge test of you guys, and you're like, everybody should keep their original accents dictum.
And in my anti-bad Southern accent crusade, I'm going to be part of the problem, probably.
Katie, a lot of your principles are about to get,
I know,
you know, thrown at the wall.
It's going to retroactively ruin my wedding, and it's going to be so worth it.
Or we could do just a commentary like Joe and I did with Mean Girls.
Oh, my gosh.
That's so standard. So typical.
So typical. We've only done it once.
Yeah, exactly.
We could do a commentary in character.
Oh, my
God.
That would require a stronger actor than I am.
I believe in you.
Well...
Well, we're all going to have to gear up for whatever we do, because my God.
I am filled with so much horror at this concept that...
We should plan it for around the time the Transformers movie comes out, just to help us survive that.
Oh, counter-programming in the extreme.
I haven't looked at like what we have to dread coming up, because Godzilla was so good. I like feel so good about blockbusters, and I know it's all going to go away so soon.
It has been a really good year for blockbusters, because hello, Captain America, the Lego movie.
Mm-hmm. 22 yeah. Jump Street's coming up soon.
Yeah.
And then we get Transformers.
I love 21 Jump Street, but I have to admit that the trailer for 22 does not make me laugh.
I haven't seen it.
The first trailer for 22 did not make me laugh. The newer one does, and it gives me so much hope, because like...
Well, the joke about the Spanish accents made me laugh in the second trailer, but
that's funny.
That's about it.
There's a female character that shows up in the new trailer that is in some sort of like fighting / attracted to Jonah Hill thing that really looks like it could be really funny.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I remember that. She was really funny.
Oh, this is the most uncomfortable fist fight I've ever had. That one.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Steel Magnolias anniversary, by the way, coincides with the release of Dumb and Dumber 2. And
you're taking us all the way to November though.
Yeah. And Foxcatcher. And Fury, the Brad Pitt, Shia LaBeouf.
Oh.
Well, we're actually doing Steel Magnolias as part of the Supporting Actress SmackDown on the site
yes.
for August.
Nice.
Oh.
Nathaniel, your whole site is going to be blush and bashful, and you can't just limit it to one feature. Steel Magnolias were the Avengers before there were Avengers. Like, we need to honor them appropriately.
We can do it the same weekend as the Expendables 3, just to tie it together.
That's
exact counter-programming.
I feel like I have to find some way to limit it, or Steel Magnolias is going to take over the site for the rest of the year.
Why would you ever limit it?
I know, what's wrong with that?
Because it is way too omnipresent in my life.
I can't even understand that claim.
None of you live with someone who puts it on once a week.
So what you're saying is, like, you're like Drum, and the movie is like the birds that he's shooting at in the beginning of the movie.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm just impressed you give him control of the remote once a week. That's more than I had actually conjectured. But...
Thanks for coming to this chit-chat about Godzilla and Neighbors. Once again, my guests were Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
Ta-ta.
Joe Reed from The Wire.
Roar!
And Katie Rich from Vanity Fair.
Roar! I'm better than Joe.
And I'm for mine, I'm just going to insert Godzilla's actual roar show you all up. It's my indigenous accent.
I'll be over here rubbing a nuclear weapon against my ovaries.